Human Adventure. From Station WGN with the University of Chicago for the radio audience of the Middle West. These evenings, through science and scholarship, enter with us upon a new search toward the fuller understanding of our universe, ourselves, and our society. Our story is the story of man's search for knowledge, which is science, his search for wisdom, which is scholarship, the adventure in ideas, which is the human adventure. This day, from his own secret manuscript, a man speaks out for himself and for his age. This hour, from one of the world's great diaries, Samuel Pepys.
But, Lord, what if I did give her a little kiss, she being a very pretty humid girl?
Oh, go away with you, Mr. Pepys.
And so home. And there told my wife a fair tale, God knows how I spent the whole day, with which she, poor wretch, was satisfied, or seemed so. And so to bed. The World's End, a drinking house. And there, merry with Mr. Peachell, whose red nose, I confess, makes me ashamed to be seen with him, though otherwise a good-natured man.
And how does my good friend Samuel Pepys, Esquire of Axyard, latterly of Seething Lane? And what is this curious experiment the Royal Society proposes, which have I here hired a poor debauched man for 20 shillings... to have some of the blood of a sheep let into his body?
Why, Mr. Evelyn, 'tis for science. 'Tis like this.
Pepys and his royal master, Charles II.
Ah, our trusted servant, Mr. Pepys, who discharges our business of the Navy so well. Odd's fish, Mr. Pepys, you have kept our fleet for sea against the Dutch, and have made our ships fit and seen to the provisioning of them. Look that the plague does not touch our Mr. Pepys.
Your servant, Majesty, your servant indeed.
And this is Samuel Pepys, gentleman of Restoration England, chief civilian officer of Charles II's Navy, president of the Learned Royal Society, member of Parliament, lover of music and books, as of wine and women. Dead these 243 years is Mr. Pepys, yet he remains a man with whom you may cheerfully sit any night of your life. Why do a multitude of readers through the generations come to know Pepys better than they know most of their friends? Among the reasons why...
Speaking as an historian, I find the diary establishes and verifies the complex and elusive realities of a past era.
As a critic, to me, the diary achieves the intention of every serious work of literature, the revelation of human personality.
I'm a writer. To me, Pepys is an artist. He made his thoughts and his experiences live.
Well, I'm an ordinary reader. I like Pepys because he's honest. When Pepys talked to his diary, he told it nothing but the truth.
Thus, from varying fields, various verdicts on Samuel Pepys and his secret writings. This hour, as from the diary, the man himself emerges. We shall find him a quaint, a delightful, a candid, and a charming companion on our own Our Human Adventure. The year is 1819. The place, Cambridge University, Magdalen College. The master of Magdalen, the Honorable and Reverend George Neville, shows the hereditary visitor, Lord Braybrook, through Magdalen Library.
And here, my Lord Braybrook, is an ornament to the college library. The Bibliotheca Pepysiana, it is called. The private library of the graduate of this college, one Samuel Pepys, class of 1654, secretary of the Admiralty in the time of Charles II, and dead since 1703. There stand the old cases, the man's very books in their very order, as if ready to his ghostly hand.
Interesting, Dr. Neville, interesting. Written in cipher, so it would seem.
Yes, I've leafed them through. It would be a labor indeed to penetrate the cipher.
Diary, thank you. The diary of Mr. John Evelyn, who lived at that same time, has been a success this very year. Can this be deciphered, do you think?
Why, sir, there is among the undergraduates of St. John's College a divinity student who struggles against the anonymity of the name John Smith. He has a certain reputation as a cryptographer. It may be, my lord, he could read it. I'd be glad to ask him.
Good. Let's have Mr. Smith at it. Set him to work.
Why he couldn't say what he wanted to say in plain English is beyond me. But no, he had to resort to this gibberish. And yet, cipher seems like more like a kind of shorthand. Let's see, shorthand systems of the time. Shelton's tachygraphy. Library sent me this. We'll give it a try. Looks promising. Now, to compare Shelton with his Pepys manuscript page. Let's see, working out the opening passage. Suppose you read it, Dr. Neville.
Blessed be God, at the end of the last year, I was in very good health, without any sense of the old pain since having been cut of the stone.
And from there, he tells us, I live in X yard, having my wife and servant Jane, and no other in family than us three. My own private condition very handsome, and esteemed rich, but indeed very poor.
John Smith has soon deciphered long passages to show to the master of the college. And in turn, the master, the Honorable and Reverend George Neville, reports to Lord Braybrook, the hereditary visitor.
And so, my lord, there it is. A self-portrait of this fellow Pepys. 10 years of the Restoration, 1660 to 1669. More than a million words recaptured for us. See how in these passages Smith gets the fellow.
The voices of 1660 begin to speak. Pepys laboring long over his journal to record them, as he tells us...
I stayed up till the bellman came by with his bell under my window, as I was writing at this very line, and cried...
Past 1 o'clock in a cold, frosty, windy morning.
Then I to bed, and left my wife and the maid a-washing still. Home from Holland, the fleet bringing Charles II, who is to be restored to his rightful place... And to Dover in most glorious weather, for my kinsman, Sir Edward Montagu, come to me in my cabin, he being general at sea of the Navy.
We must have a little patience, Pepys, and we will rise together. In the meantime, I promise you all the good jobs I can. And in token of our future under the King, I bring here the King's bill, making you clerk of the X in the Navy office. £500 a year. And for myself, here is the royal warrant, creating me first Earl of Sandwich.
The Lord and you be praised. Coming home, I to the taking of my wife's kitchen accounts at the end of this month, and there find 7 shillings wanting, which did occasion a very high falling out between us, she confessing that when she do miss a sum, she do add something to other charges to make it up, I calling her a beggar, which she took very stomachfully. We parted after many high words very angry, and I to my office to do my month's accounts, and find that Montague prophesied truly, for myself am worth £1,270, for which the Lord God be praised.
And here, London, in the plague year of 1665.
To my great trouble, hear that the plague has come into the city. Sad news of the death of so many in the parish. 40 last night, the bell always going. Lord, the number of houses visited. What do you there, fellow?
I come here to Fenchurch Street to mark the plague cross upon Dr. Burnett's door that is taken with the plague, poor man. But he hath discovered it himself first and caused himself to be shut up of his own accord. See, he hath marked the cross upon his door. And look what he hath writ there.
Lord, have mercy upon us, he hath writ. My old friends. My old friends.
July.
I must part with my wife to keep her from the plague, and so have sent her to Woolwich with her 2 maids.
There now I, too, to visit her.
Sad days, you say, husband, now come upon the town.
Lord, wife, how everybody's looks and discourse in the street is of death and nothing else. And few people going up and down, that the town is like a place distressed and forsaken.
The life at court is not much nowadays, I trow. Has seen my Lady Castlemaine and the king?
No, for the king and all are gone, there being several plague houses in King Street near the palace. The officers do now bury the dead in the open fields near the river, and the people die so that they are fain to carry the dead by daylight, the night's not sufficing to do it. Wife, I shall draw anew my will, the town growing so unhealthy that a man cannot depend upon living 2 days. When this is done, I shall be in a much better state of soul. Then I shall go back to the city. I must go back.
August.
What do you hear in the city, Mr. Pete?
Why, my good friend, Sir William Coventry, Commissioner of the Navy.
We had thought you gone from town.
No, Sir William. I and my clerks have taken quarters at Greenwich. I join such colleagues as venture into London for the meetings at the Navy office. Someone must look to our war with the Dutch, or it will go worse.
Well spoken, Mr. Pete.
You, sir, took your turn of the sword. I must not grudge to take mine of the pestilence.
September.
The whole general number of dead this week is 8,297, and of them by the plague 7,165. The biggest bill of mortality yet. There have died upwards of 100,000 in London. Never a physician and but one apothecary left, all being dead. Yet still, I am not touched, and I repeat in my mind,
thou shalt not be afraid for my terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, or the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the sickness that destroyeth in the noonday. 1,000 shall fall beside thee, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee.
Yet I still stay. Lord, Lord, I am afraid. I am afraid.
January 1666.
Now the cold weather comes, and the great frosts abate the malignancy that is in the air, so that the coaches with 4 horses begin again to come into the town, and a delightful thing it is to see the town full of people again, as now it is, and the king is returned. And the king came to me of himself, Your Majesty.
Mr. Pepys, I do give you thanks for your good service all this year, and I do assure you that I'm very sensible of it.
Mr. Pepys, my lord, is indeed the right hand of the Navy.
I do thank your highness, and you too, my lord.
Samuel Pepys is in the Admiralty office. His business, a stubborn 3-year war with the stubborn Dutch. Yet one more service he does his king, a direct service at the royal command. For in September of 1666, a flare in the sky above Pudding Lane, a billow of fire over Fish Street, a roaring arch of flame from the tower to London Bridge, the Great Fire of London.
Go, Mr. Pepys, to my Lord Mayor. Command him to spare no houses.
Spare no houses, Majesty?
Bid him pull down every one before the fire.
Pull down all before the fire, Majesty. I understand. In Canning Street met my Lord Mayor like a man spent, with a handkerchief about his neck, his face all black.
He's ruined for all of us, Mr. Pepys.
My Lord, his Majesty directs that the houses in the path of the fire be wrecked.
What can I do? I am spent. People will not obey me. We have been pulling down the houses. The fire overtakes us faster than we can do it.
So, having no help from him, I look to myself, carrying my goods to the garden, my gold to the cellar, and bearing my wine and farmers and cheese. The Lord Mayor would not act, resolved to act myself. So to Admiral Sir William Penn.
What brings you, Mr. Pepys?
Sir William, let us lose no time. Send the dockyard hands from Woolwich and Deptford to pull down houses and save the Navy office. The king commands it. The fire approaches.
Why, it is a good scheme, Mr. Pepys. You here, lads? In with you. Get those houses down. Clear away all.
So is my good sent safely by 2 lighters to Sir William Riders at Bethnal Green, and £2,350 in gold under watch of my wife and my clerk while you are at Woolwich. Return for the sorrowful sight as I thought of gazing upon my burned office and home, but the Lord God be praised. Found them unharmed.
It is waning now, Mr. Pepys.
Indeed, a great stop given to the fire by the men brought out of the King's Yard by Sir William Penn and by the Duke of York and his soldiers, gallantly blowing up houses on Ludgate Hill, all but encircled by fire.
13,000 houses and 90 churches are reduced to ashes in the great fire. And as Pepys prudently notes, £600,000 a year are lost in rents. Yet if the fire is a calamity, the Dutch war is a black disgrace. For before the year 1667 brings the peace, the guns of the Dutch fleet are booming in the Thames and the Medway.
Sick men from the fleet lie starving before our Navy office doors all night and all day, poor wretches. The King do mind nothing but pleasure and hates the very sight or thought of business. Everybody nowadays reflect upon Cromwell and commend him for brave things he did and made all the neighbor princes fear him. And so in my travail to church, hoping for consolation, but did hear the Duke of Albemarle's chaplain make a simple sermon. For, reproaching the imperfection of human learning, he cried,
"All our physicians cannot tell what an ague is, and all our arithmetic is not able to number the days of a man."
Which, God knows, is not the fault of arithmetic. And then, coming into the crowd of seamen again, above 100 of them followed, some cursing, some swearing, and some praying to me.
Pity! Pay
us, Mr. Pete! We serve, Mr. Pete!
Keep it down with your command,
dear. We'll have our money on this new day for you, Mr. Pete!
First distress, then riot and mutiny, and all because of the idleness and incapacity of those in high places. The fleet is in such a position as to discipline as if the devil himself commanded it. And nobody here to mind the business of the Navy but myself. What can I do? The treasury is empty. God remove this difficulty. God save England.
War, plague, fire, and defeat at sea, the profligacy of the court, the idle weakness of the king. These things are a shame and scandal in Restoration England. Then as now, men seek to refute scandal by naming a scapegoat. Yet before the bar of an angry House of Commons, the amazing little diarist refuses to be a scapegoat.
I did comfort myself with a half pint of malt sack at Dog Tavern, a dram of brandy at Mrs. Hewlett's stall in Westminster Hall. So at last, stand at the bar of the House, and there for more than 3 hours spoke in defense of my office. All the world that was within hearing did congratulate me and cry up upon my speech. And even the King, Duke of York, came to me both, Your Majesty.
Mr. Pepys, I'm glad to hear of your success yesterday. I hear that you are another Cicero.
Well then, Your Majesty, you must indeed have convinced our masters at Westminster, for they had made me out another Catiline. But in truth, what are such compliments? What are such compliments from such a king?
Staunch servant of the state, Pepys is father of the English civil service, restorer of the Navy, man of business and man of affairs. And in his diary, the life of London. In his diary, Pepys dines.
A fricassee of rabbits and chickens, a leg of mutton boiled, 3 carps in a dish, a great dish of a side of lamb, a dish of roasted pigeons, a dish of 4 lobsters, 3 tarts, a lamprey pie, a most rare pie, a dish of anchovies, good wine of several sorts, and all things noble and to my great content.
Pepys dines, and Pepys lives 40 years after the meal just described. Pepys attends the theater, goes backstage, takes us with him.
To the King's Playhouse, and there did see a mighty pretty play, and Mrs. Nip and the women do well, but above all, little Nelly Gwynn. So after the act, to the retiring room, and there Nip and Nell dressing herself, and is very pretty, prettier than I thought.
Why, Mr. Pepys, well met. And here's our Jade Nell, who's to do a tween act song with me.
I salute you, Mistress Nelly. And to think that in a mad part you do beyond imitation of
Nelly! Nelly Gwynn! Nellie!
Oh, but the audience calls, Nell. Tis Barbary Allen, Mr. Pepys, the Scott song. Come, Nellie, we're on.
Coming. We shall meet again, Mr. Pepys.
But, Lord, see how they paint themselves. And how poor the men in their stage clothes. But yet, what a brave show they make on the stage by candlelight. Pretty, witty Nelly. Now, when the years are gone, I cannot blame the king, whose mistress she was, and indeed, in dying, he showed his devotion to her. For his last words were of her, and he saying, "Don't let poor Nelly starve." And I kissed her. That was almost like a queen. The mighty pretty soul she was. And so away pleased. And especially kissing of Nell.
And Pepys kisses still another pretty girl, his serving maid, Deb Willett.
I did give her a little kiss, but sad to say, so occasioned the greatest sorrow to me that I ever knew in the world. For as I did give her a little kiss...
Mr. Pepys, what do you there with Willett?
Why, my dear, that is the tie of Deb's apron did come undone, and as you did perceive, I was fixing it.
So that's what you were doing.
But in truth, my wife, coming up suddenly, did find me embracing the girl. I was at a wonderful loss upon it, but when her voice came to her, my wife flew out to very high terms.
Leave, Willett, you and Mr. Pepys. I saw you, Mr. Pepys, preferring a sorry girl before me, a slighted, dishonored, and abused by the husband I trusted.
And so to bed.
Well, here's a note Mr. Pepys did slip me this morning. My dear Deb, I continue to deny that I ever kissed you. And by this you may govern yourself. The truth is, I do adventure upon God's pardoning me this lie, knowing how heavy a thing it would be for me to be the ruin of you. Poor girl. S.P.
What an impassioned note! Mr. Pepys must have dipped into the same ink that he uses to figure the Navy accounts. Oh,
what have you there, Willett? Hand it over. Come, let loose.
Oh, Mrs. Pepys.
That's the way it is. Perjuring villain, and you go. So he hugged you, eh?
Yes, Mrs. Pepys.
And he kissed you, eh?
Oh, yes, Mrs. Pepys.
Jade.
Here, Mrs. Pepys. My dear, why abuse your Willett so?
You rogue, you villain. I've got to confession her from all.
Oh, my lord.
She must be gone this instant.
So, with tears in my eyes, which I could not help, I did discharge her and advised her never to see me or let me see her more, which she took with tears, too. Then, blessed be God, my wife and I did sleep well with peace, which I have not done in now almost 20 nights together. So there was, beyond my hopes, a durable peace. But soon it seemed more an armistice.
You've been seeing her again. I can tell from your hangdog look. You sly rogue.
Oh, let me sleep. I know nothing of her, nor what she do, nor what becomes of her.
Well, I have discharged my other maid.
The handsome one?
Yes, and hired one that is marked of the smallpox. With one such as you, we must not overtax frailty.
Which do mightily vex me, though I said nothing, and it do vex me still. But... I know where Deb hath gone, and do have the address of her new place, which she left at Herringman's by bookseller, sealed in paper at my instruction. So...
For 3 years, John Smith labors to decipher Pepys, and often the story is somber, as sometimes it is gay. For Pepys does not escape the sorrow that is our common lot.
Today, died in her 30th year, my dear wife Elizabeth, after 14 years together, a time happier than most know. A most grievous and sad sight to see her lie now still and cold and pale like a stone. And so, This was the end of my wife. And I thinking back how she used to make coal fires and wash my foul clothes with her own hands for me, poor wretch. In our little room for which I ought forever to love and admire her and do. And persuade myself that if God had reduced us to it and she had been spared to me, she would have done the same again.
You bear your ear at St. Olive's, Mr. Pepys?
Yes, Mr. Sexton. And not in the churchyard, but under the stones beside my mother, where someday I shall lie with her. And now, being come to the grave, Mr. Wills, the minister of the parish, to read the service for Periel.
For man that is born of woman hath but a short time to live, and is full of misery. He cometh up and is cut down like a flower. He fleeth as if it were a shadow, and never continueth in one stay.
And so saw my wife laid in the grave, and afterward alone among the gravestones of the churchyard, in meditation upon our mortal fabric. But, Lord, to see how the world makes nothing of a man. A year, yea, a day, an hour, after he is gone.
And yet, Mr. Pepys, do they not remember you? Do they not talk with you still? Drink a draught of Lambeth ale with you at the Dog Tavern? Do they not come to your blue chamber still? This is Pepys' farewell to his journal and to us. His final entry, May 31st, 1669.
And thus ends all that I doubt that I shall ever be able to do with my own eyes in the keeping of my journal, having done now so long as to undo my eyes almost every time that I take a pen in hand, and therefore resolve from this time forward to have it kept by my people in long hand, and must be contented to set down no more than is fit for them and all the world to know. And so I betake myself to that course which is almost as much as to see myself go into my grave, for which, and all the discomforts that will accompany my being blind, good God, prepare me.
Closing the diary as Pepys puts by his pen, it is pleasant to record that he escaped blindness, that he won through troublous times with astonishing inventiveness and energy, that he died in his 71st year, loved, respected, honored, leaving his diary to his college at Cambridge. Dead these 243 years is Mr. Pepys. But to all who read, his journal remains fresh, informative, quaintly and colorfully spoken. Dead 243 years is Mr. Pepys, yet he remains a man with whom you may cheerfully sit any night of your life.
The Human Adventure is jointly presented by station WGN and the University of Chicago. Selected programs are transcribed for rebroadcast by the Overseas Network of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Music was by Kenneth Churchill, the conductor Robert Trendler. The writer, in cooperation with the University of Chicago, George Morgenstern. The script editor, Francis Coughlin. The director, Morrison Wood. 1 week from tonight, The Human Adventure will present The Fall of the Roman Empire, a study in disunion pertinent to our time.
That's next week, The Fall of the Roman Empire.
The role of Samuel Pepys was portrayed by Herbert Butterfield. This is WGN Chicago, serving the Middle West.